Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. We're continuing our study of community, and in the study of community, we've heard about the emotional ups and downs, the energetic ups and downs, the challenges that turn into gifts, and the basis for community in some spiritual practices, and, or maybe I should say that community is a part of the spiritual base of a spiritual practice. And in the process of exploring community, I've been involved in finding out about community and regenerative communities. And this is a totally different, I would say, perspective or viewpoint of community and how we as a community of Reiki practitioners and students can make a difference in the world. There is a place, of course, for me in Reiki where we have relationship with the earth, but sometimes how to actually nourish that relationship with the earth, and the earth meaning not just the soil underneath our feet, but the earth as an entity, is very, sometimes can feel very hopeless and helpless. So I have with me today a woman who has inspired me a great deal in the last few months since I've known her. She's a member of a group called Regenesis, and she can talk more about that. And her name is Kate Tyrion, and I'm so happy to not only have you with me on the show, Kate, but also to know that you live only an hour away from me, which is wonderful. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phyllis. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, great. So I usually start by asking people to share with us how you met Reiki, and, you know, that's kind of our meeting point for everybody on the show, and then we kind of go from there.
I had experiences in my early life that sort of led me to seek out healing modalities, and it actually began with psychotherapy when I was 29. Within a year, I was starting to question why I was on the planet. I got the sense somewhere inside myself it was not about getting up, going to work, earning money, coming home, and all that, and I was a single mom at the time. And I got sick a year later, and 18 months later I got sick again, both with very significant illnesses, and the potential for my body going away was significant. So it alarmed me. I'd never felt weak before in my life, and all of a sudden I was weak. 6 months of weakness following my second illness. And I started to explore the whole idea of my body health and the relationship of how that was reflected in the world and the planet body. And so I went on a path of seeking to understand what I could do so that I wouldn't become sick again, and started to make all those rich connections with what was there and available to support this healing journey, both emotionally, physically, psychically, spiritually. And lots of doorways opened, and I walked through a lot of them, and some didn't keep me there. But in the late 80s, I found Reiki as part of a living food, raw food, physical support health program. And it was the first time, actually, that I had a tangible experience of energy as a healing modality, as opposed to just the intellectual experience of understanding it.
Right.
And so it really resonated with me, and I was initiated in the late 80s into the level, first degree of Reiki. And I began to practice that. And it opened just those inner channels in myself and the connection to the larger universe. And so I followed that path and continued on that. As this stepping out of a career in business moved into my commitment to working with the earth itself, mm-hmm. with land. And it sort of was one of the doorways that came together over a period of 2 or 3 years where my life shifted dramatically from what it was to what it is now. It really was one of the big doorways for me.
Wonderful. But your story goes on about the earth, so do you want to just continue?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I dropped out of my career of almost 19 years at the peak of that career and went to UC Santa Cruz to study ecological horticulture. It is the premier program in this country for working with food production systems. They've been going at it since the 60s. And it's an extraordinary place. And it really deepened this understanding I have of how I could shift what was happening in my life and my actions, my choices, how they had this ripple effect mm-hmm. on everything. That each of us has this opportunity by what decisions we make about how we live our life and what we choose to spend money on, what we choose as needs or wants or desires, and where we focus that energy, and what happens as a result of that. So I'll give a for example.
Okay, that'd be great.
As a young woman, I was at the London School of Fashion in the 60s. I grew up in Wales, and I was a country girl with this wonderful life with four sisters and my father who taught agriculture, my mom who was a naturalist, who engaged us in the world in which we lived. It was an 11th century farmhouse. It was non-industrial agriculture. It was that enchanting, lovely life you have. I moved a long way from that. London in the 60s when everything in fashion and music was happening in
right.
that place.
Yeah, definitely.
So my desire was, you know, I'd love a floor-length fox coat. I wanted to eat at fine restaurants. I wanted to wear Charles Jourdan shoes. You know, I wanted all that. I became a realtor in Southern California. You know, I drove the Mercedes. We ate at fine restaurants. I wore silk suits to work and so on. But it was so hollow. And my sense is that this illness in me emerged out of this longing for meaning in my life. Mm-hmm. And so that became the thing that focused me, was getting sick. It really was a great gift. So when I went to Santa Cruz, it was sort of a fulfillment, I thought, of where I was going. This was going to be my life. But what I've discovered, it was just another doorway. And not just a doorway, because it was an education beyond anything I could have dreamed of. It was a hands-on program. It was physically demanding. I was one of the older people in the community, and we lived together as a community of people.
Really?
We did.
Oh, I didn't understand that.
On this beautiful campus, wow. overlooking the Monterey Bay, with extraordinary hand-worked gardens that had been producing organic food for 25 years at
wow.
that point. The soils were 3 feet deep, full of life.
Right.
And not only was the food that came out of it absolutely delicious and sumptuous, we were feeding ourselves and selling this into the world, but it was stunningly beautiful as well. And for me, an inner artist and a visionary, that's a core about who I am. And to marry the idea of growing my own food, nurturing my body, creating beauty that was edible beauty, as well as food for pollinators, for the birds, for the bees, for the butterflies, that I wasn't feeding just myself, but I was feeding a larger system mm-hmm. of life. And that I could be an active participant engaged in this. And I was with others who were enthusiastic and thought physical hard work was not just a great way to get in shape and stay in shape, but it was a sense where your body was so full of life
uh-huh.
because of your engagement with life itself.
Wonderful.
And so the energetic of Reiki, the energetic of the earth and the universe,
mm-hmm.
and the energetic of the food we produce,
mm-hmm.
it was so enlivening. And John Robbins' book in the 80s called Diet for a New America, which was an examination of our industrial agriculture, is a horrifying wake-up call for me. My 17-year-old daughter read it at that time, and there were notes on the refrigerator every morning about some horror she read about in this book, about the abuse that we inflict yes. on animals, on poultry, on the earth. And I said, what is it we put in our bodies when we eat that?
Right.
What do we do to the earth body when we eat that?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to people who grow that food and social justice?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the environment? And there I was at the UC farm where there's never been a chemical applied that wasn't something that was benign in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And to see this level of flourishing and joy that was experienced there.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. It's where the biodynamic, Rudolf Steiner's work, was first expressed in the United States. And it's also where the French intensive culture of food growing is there, which is based on how the Parisians fed themselves in the 19th century in Paris, concentrated quantities of food in small spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So all this fed the notion that we don't need this large commercial industrial food system, that in natural systems there's a resilience through multiples of complex small things that have connections to each other, beneficial connections. And that's where resilience in nature lies. So to have things perched on a pinhead is so not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
An example of that would be when the Icelandic volcano went off, I think it was last year in 2010,
mm-hmm.
and the airport in London was closed for a week. I learned that 50% of all the vegetables and 95% of all the fruit consumed in Britain is flown in every week.
Yes.
So during that week, that food supply did not show up there. And it sat me back on my heels, and I started to think about this way that we have gone and how stupid it is. I can't think of a better word to say that. That it's not that people need to be starving or to be hungry. It's that we just don't know how simple it is, what common sense it is, to grow our food locally in good, rich, live soil that's full of life itself, how that translates to us energetically, and how then we can contribute to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be through the Reiki system or whatever system it is we choose.
Right.
But it amps up our own field of life. And if our field of life is functioning at its maximum, what then do we have to bring to everything else
mm-hmm.
that we're engaged in?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great question. Well, I mean, it's interesting because I have lots of friends in the UK, and several of them are involved now in community gardens, which evidently is a huge explosion of community gardens
mm-hmm.
and living up to my stereotype of the English gardener, right? But these are not only flowers, obviously, but lots of vegetables and so on. And when that happened, when the food stores couldn't get their produce and so on, they were just simply going to their garden as usual and getting their food.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting because this community garden started with, I think, 4 or 5 people who were hearty souls. I mean, really hearty souls as far as I'm concerned, because I saw what this place was when they started, which looked like rock and bramble mm-hmm. to me. And they've turned it into this amazing production of sustenance, which
uh-huh.
is great. And they're feeding not only that, this community garden, I think, now has increased. I'm not quite sure of the numbers now, but maybe 20, 25 people are involved, really committed, and then a few on the outskirts. But they're actually feeding themselves and part of the community in which they live.
Wonderful.
So it's becoming kind of famous around the area. So people are actually, like, this is so totally beyond me as an American. People in Wales, because it's in the north part of Wales, right in the borderlands, they are, like, moving to this little town to be near the community garden.
Uh-huh.
And, like, I can't imagine that in the United States, but in England, of course, I get that, or in the UK. So fascinating, fascinating process. And I know that there are community gardens that others of my friends in the UK are involved in and very excited by. Very exciting. And I think about when I go to Russia and I ride on the train and you go by in the outskirts of the cities, all the gardening space that's out there and all these people in the city who have this little plot of land that they, you know, garden in during the summer and go out there and enjoy their connection with the earth. It just feels like so important. And they, and it's a, it's just something that is a part of their life, mm-hmm. and I don't see them giving that up very readily. So I think that brings us to the topic of community. So, you know, I see that I'm talking about a community that kind of evolved around a garden. But I suppose that your viewpoint of community is a bit different than this, in the sense that you know, this is a relatively small-scale garden, but I'm wondering, when you talk about food production, for instance, and the larger global community, and it's the strategy for providing food for that global community is not working, and actually, in the last year or two, the bankers and everybody have gotten that globalization, whoever thought of this. I mean, it seemed efficient, I guess, that all the corn should be grown in Iowa and all the beets should be grown someplace else and all the, you know, whatever. But it's not really appropriate land use, and it doesn't form community. It forms these singular kinds of entities that have hardly any connection with human beings, it seems.
It actually, excuse me, it actually destroys community.
Mm-hmm.
Presently in Africa, there's a recognition in the world of people who are sort of people with money who want to place it somewhere that they feel there's going to be a future for them to make money on it. So there's a land grab of sorts going on in Africa right now, where people who have this kind of economic resource are purchasing land and pushing off people that have been growing food there for generations upon generations. And because they are peasant farmers or subsistence growers of food, they have no voice.
Uh-huh.
And so it is exacerbating a problem that already exists. And climate change is exacerbating this problem because we're getting more extreme weather patterns. The droughts are occurring frequently. There have been 2 100-year droughts in the Amazon in a period of 5 years, for example. So there's this level of desperation and need in populations that can no longer graze their cattle because of water issues. And it's pushing into conflict, and you're getting others that are using that conflict for their own gain.
Mm-hmm.
And corporations aren't in it for the human beings that and our needs. Corporations serve their own interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the system is, in my mind, is sort of like a cancer gone awry. It's metastasized. And what we need to bring back is this health into the entire global system of food production. And not just human food, but human food for all the living parts of
right.
the system.
Right.
And so it needs. We need an understanding of water. We need an understanding of soils. There's this wonderful, wonderful film based on a book called Dirt, The Ecstatic Skin of the Earth. The film is called Dirt the Movie. Marvelous people, so fascinating. And one of the lines at the beginning of this, which comes from the book, is there is only one planet in the known universe with a skin covering on it that we call dirt. And it's the matrix from which all life springs when you put water to it. It is the living substance out of which everything emerges. And I go back to the deepest roots of this planet, the time when the atmosphere was carbon dioxide, and over time from single cell to multi-cell entities, plants, life forms grew that thrived on carbon, ingested it, and put out oxygen, which shifted the balance of the atmosphere, and those plants then got buried. And as we use petroleum products, we take the bodies of those animal, plants, and creatures that absorb the carbon in the atmosphere, and by using it to fuel things, we release that atmosphere back into what we have been able to breathe. So plants actually are the creatures, the beings that have allowed us to live on this planet. And now we're shifting that, and we're taking forests out. This country, the United States, used to be largely forest.
Right.
My country of Britain was largely forest.
Right.
Nottingham, Ham, Birmingham, Ham. Ham meant a clearing in the forest. So we have taken...
Now there's hardly a forest in the clearing.
Right. That's exactly right. So Robin Hood's forest is gone. And what happens when we remove those producers of oxygen? So what we need to do is bring that back. We need to understand how water moves and how we keep water in these drying systems. The globe is becoming drier in places that it's already arid, where billions of people live. Glaciers are starting to dry up that feed four of the biggest rivers in Asia, the Ganges, the Yellow River. Billions of people and agriculture depend on these things. I don't know why we are resistant to accepting the fact that we're in a time that we need to shift the way we behave in order to shift what is happening. There's so much delusion being created, the smoke and mirrors to keep us engaged in issues that have really, in the scheme, the long scheme of things, no meaning, because what they do is distract us from what really is essential. And what's essential is refocusing our thinking about how do we keep this planet to be a livable place that can serve all of us over the long time. I'm so full of so much that I want to say that I'm not quite sure what the next piece, and did I actually answer your question? Can you tell I get excited about this?
That's wonderful. Well, yes, I mean, I'll take us back for myself and see maybe, I think your question about did I answer the question is kind of a yes, no. I think I got much more than I asked for, so that's the yes part. But to take it back a little simpler, I grew up in Iowa, you know, in farming country. And at that point, you know, I have no idea how big their farms were, but maybe I would guess maybe 120 acres was a kind of average size. If you were really rich, you had 600 acres if you had a big family to be able to farm it and so on. And, you know, at that point, our grocery store was actually, they bought mostly local produce. And so we had corn when it was corn season, and we had apples when it was in the fall, and we never had mushrooms, ever. We always picked them wild.
Yes, yes.
But we, I mean, the store never sold mushrooms. And, you know, my mom is one of these, I don't know where she got it, but anyway, she was always looking for exotic food. I mean, it just used to drive me crazy because we would be served, like, beef. She went through this thing about serving beef tongue. I mean, I don't know where she got this, but I just thought, I hope she gets off of this kick really soon. And, but she went out and she, you know, for a 3-hour drive and got mushrooms, you know, or cranberry, fresh cranberries or something crazy like that. And then when I got into college and got out of college, and, you know, the Safeway store started to bring in lots of different things, I just thought, wow, this is really cool. You know, we can have apples all year round, and we don't have to eat cabbage so much in the winter and like that. But in the time that I've been away from Iowa, which has been most of my adult life, I go back now, and what I see are abandoned farmhouses, huge, huge expanses of fields without fences because there are no animals anymore. And there's no life. Like, you can't see a person. I don't know who tills the soil or anything, but, you know, just for this, as far as you can see, which is quite a long way in Iowa, in the where I live, you just see these rolling hills of plowed fields, and it's just so strange. There's no houses, there's no people. I mean, it got kind of eerie when I went back this summer, because there are just these massive fields of corn. And it used to be that you would see corn, soybeans, alfalfa, sorghum. I don't even know if they grow sorghum anymore. It was a kind of sweetener. I guess they made molasses out of it.
They make a syrup out of it.
And they also fed cattle with it. So, I mean, you know, there were all these different crops that you could identify. And now there's just one crop. And it just was kind of, again, very eerie. And so there's no people. You know, the people are in these little towns, and they're kind of subsisting. I don't know how they actually earn their living, but it's a very sad thing, because the life has gone out of this little farming community, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, it has, and it happened post-World War II, really. 85% of people farmed and lived in the rural areas before World War II moved to the urban centers, and they used barracks technology to build houses. It's where that first kind of what you think of as California developments happened, to house the soldiers in the war. You know, you're putting up 2x4s and all that stuff. And when people came back from the war, this became the way you built urban centers. And there was a decision made in Europe after the war to focus on social issues like health, education, and so on as they rebuilt. In the United States, there was an actual decision made by a man to become, for this to become a consumer society, to sell everybody on the idea that we needed stuff. And we were going to produce stuff in the factories that had produced this, all the armaments for the war. So we turned ourselves around into consumers of everything on the planet, which has drained the natural systems that support all of us and all life on the planet, which is so integral and woven together and interrelated. And the other thing that happened with this was that we bladed the landscape clear. So we're sort of echoing the war theme. You blade everything alive off it, you put up the barracks housing, and then you plant stuff that necessarily doesn't belong there, comes from somewhere else. And then you use all the war chemicals that you used for bombs, and you use those to destroy anything that's alive on your plants in your garden. So the fertilizers and the pesticides are converted from war chemicals, which is why today people make bombs from agricultural fertilizers. It's just that we've been playing that game back and forth since the wars went on. So we're sort of echoing this theme of war, and we've abandoned the countryside to large industry, which doesn't have a personal connection with the rhythms of that. And we've deadened all these rural communities. And we've made farming something disconnected in that people drive tractors and they're in air-conditioned cabs listening to music. They don't touch the soil anymore. But my sense is that no one really wants to do farming the way my father did it, with a student where you're actually physically working hard at labor. So I've been thinking a lot for my own community about what a community farm might look like. And I think that my feeling is this, that we could own as a community, the community itself would own the land, and that we might have 7 farming families there that live and work in their own cluster of residences that have their own piece, that they do their own piece of farming on, but together they come to do the larger jobs that need many hands. So instead of thinking of this is how it was, this is what it's become, I think we can create something that we haven't really imagined yet for how we grow food that satisfies us and doesn't leave us feeling overburdened.
Right.
And that includes not just the needs for people, but the needs for all the other life forms that are essential to what we need.
Right.
To support the whole system. Because if we start pulling pieces out of the system, we've discovered that that's a mistake. Because when you damage bees, for example, not only do the bee populations die off, but our ability to produce food is gone, because bees are essential to pollinate things in order to produce fruits and vegetables.
Right.
They're critical. But bees cannot also thrive on monocrop, which
right.
is a single crop.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get the nutrients they need. And so then their immune systems are down. Does this sound like what affects us?
Right.
And they are susceptible then to the things that come to bombard their bodies. And so the system begins to collapse, which is what we're witnessing planet-wide right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we, each of us, are not helpless in this. I know that my small contribution to this mosaic, and it doesn't have to be large. I live on a 10,000 square foot lot in an arid climate, but it's a productive forest system that hummingbirds and cardinals and doves and all sorts of birds are nesting in and reproducing themselves. I can go out and pick apples or my salad for dinner, and my waste from my kitchen goes back into the garden. My clothes, which I usually buy used, are all made of natural fibers, and when they are too destroyed for me to give them away or to wear myself, they go to the ground to make more soil. My paper waste makes more soil. Everything I can recycle back to becoming a resource goes back into the soil. I catch the water on my sloped ground, and that slows it down long enough to soak in. Last year, I caught something like 18,000 gallons. So 3,600, if my math is correct, 5-gallon bottles of water went back into my soil to nurture the vegetation there. I didn't have to pay for the town water for that much. I
Wow.
saved that much. And that rainwater serves my soil better than the water I can get that's from the aquifer below.
Uh-huh. Well, you were telling me earlier about rainwater, and I'll repeat this for the visitor, the listeners. Kate and I were just visiting a bit before the show, and I was telling her how crazy it is here because, you know, first of all, I grew up in Iowa, where any seed that you put in the ground just grew this magnificent kind of jack-in-the-beanstalk kind of vegetable or fruit. And then I moved to Colorado, which was in the mountains, which was hopeless. At 10,000 feet, you don't get a growing season, and you have no soil, and you have hardly any rain. And it was, and I had hardly any time because I was skiing or doing something. So then when I moved down here, then I moved to Idaho, and I had the friend who was an avid gardener, so she got me back into gardening. And so I moved here to the desert of southern Arizona, and it's a kind of a crazy place because there are cactuses here, these ones called saguaros, and they look like the kid drawing of cactuses with arms. And each one of them has its own very distinctive personality. And the people that I read about, the people who have written about the saguaro say that they grow about 1 inch a year. So the ones that are like 30 or 40 feet tall are quite old. And then I have this tree, which is actually a glorified shrub that's a native in the back of my backyard. And it has grown so fast that I can't keep up with it. And it's an amazing place because of the sun. And I water not the native plants, but I water some of the non-native plants that I'm growing. And what happens with them is that they kind of survive, I would say. And they, you know, they do whatever they do and what they can do. But if it rains, then even if it's less rain than what I usually put on them to water them, somehow they respond differently, and you can really see it in the desert because the response is so quick. It's just like the cactus just look like they kind of go from being kind of little shriveled up dry husks of something, and they just expand into their skin to so they look like healthy and full of water. And like, so why is that? Why is rain so much different than the water out of my tap?
Well, the water out of your tap in an arid landscape, which is the Sonoran Desert's an arid landscape, and a huge band, about a third of the world is an arid land, and that's growing. So critical what we do here has a relationship globally. But the soils here are naturally salty. That's part of the physical makeup of soils in dry lands, because the water doesn't leach. There's not enough rainwater to leach salts out of it.
Right.
And if you're using organic products, then you're probably adding some more salt. So rainwater storage in the ground becomes very critical. But when you take water out of the ground, it has salts in it. So you're further compounding the saltiness of the soils. And so, again, that underscores the need for us to use not raised beds in the dry lands, but basin beds when we grow things, so that we can actually capture that rainwater to leach the soils of their salts below the root zone. If too much salt is in there, then the soils will actually collapse, as they are in the California agricultural regions in the San Joaquin Valley, and the plants can no longer then grow in those soils.
Wow.
So that's one reason. But the other, the response that we get in the summer is that when you get lightning striking in the atmosphere with rain, as we do here, it releases ammonia into the atmosphere, which converts atmospherically, the gases convert into becoming nitrogen. So when the rain comes down in association with lightning, what you are actually receiving, the plants are receiving, is liquid fertilizer. And it's free. And it's falling out of the sky. So the stomata on the leaves, the little openings on the leaves, open up to receive that fertilizer, and it goes into the root zone, and it takes it up as it takes every drink of that rainwater, and it responds, as you see. You know, nobody can keep up with mowing in my community of Patagonia because the grasses grow so fast, and their whole role is to grow and put out seed in this little window of time, maybe 2 months, in order to reproduce themselves. It's their absolute imperative. And the cacti expand, and those accordion ribs are there to hold the water. Their waxy surface keeps the water inside and doesn't let it leave. And all those little spines protect it from being eaten, but it also creates little shade on the surface. The fuzzy hairs on some of the cacti, it's all a mechanism for protecting the loss from the loss of water.
It creates shade?
Creates shade on the plants. So,
that is just so amazing. Like, I'm thinking about this as create shade. It creates shade.
Yeah.
Okay, I can get that. This one little sliver of shade makes a difference?
Makes a difference.
Wow.
It's like standing.
That's incredible.
It's like you standing under a tree. It's not, you know, a mesquite tree, which has those tiny leaflets,
yeah,
which again is another strategy. The small, small leaves don't need to, they don't lose water the way big leaves do, and they can hold water better.
Right.
But when you stand under that, it's not black, solid shade like a roof.
No.
It's dappled shade, and the thorns on cacti function in a similar way. So it's for them.
And it's very effective, actually.
Very effective.
I was really blown away, you know, and when I first moved here, I'm in a area where, unfortunately, new shopping malls are being built, and they plant these trees, mesquite and palo verde, all of which, well, palo verde hardly have what I would call leaves, but they do provide these strange little tree things, they do provide shade, and it totally makes a difference. Like, if I park my car, these were little spindly, maybe, I don't know how many years old, but they weren't very. And they were just barely tall enough for my car to go underneath
yeah.
it. And if I had a little bit of shade, it like made such a big difference between that and parking my car out in the sun.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I did that kind of as an experiment one day, and I went, wow, this is really amazing that it makes so much difference.
And when you look around in an intact natural environment in the desert, you'll see that the larger trees, the canopy trees, actually become like nurse trees for things that want to evolve underneath them.
Right.
So in the Sonoran Desert, the ironwood, which is really the old growth forest,
really?
Of the Sonoran Desert. They really are, some of them are ancient trees.
Wow.
And we don't think of them as an old-growth forest.
No, but they're, I know neither.
Every bit as much as maybe the Douglas firs in British Columbia.
Oh,
but
wow.
They are the mother trees that nurse the baby saguaros along, because the birds eat the fruit of the saguaro. They perch in the ironwood tree.
Right.
They drop a little packet
right.
of nutrients with a seed in it. And when the conditions are right, that seed will germinate. And the protection from the sun allows those baby cacti to start to evolve.
Uh-huh.
And so you see these guilds of relationships,
yeah.
of not just saguaro and ironwood, but a multitude of other
yes.
trees that grow together.
Yeah.
It's community.
Great. Well, let's...
Excuse me.
We could do this as a segue to people community.
Yes.
Yeah. Your work with Regenesis. So
yes.
I'm just wondering, how did you then evolve into working with Regenesis, and can you just say a little bit about the mission of Regenesis?
Yes. I first began to understand the work of Regenesis when I became a student of permaculture in 1990.
Uh-huh.
And permaculture is a whole systems way of looking at living on the earth. It takes into consideration all aspects of life. And how we can create environments that mimic natural systems, so we're not pushing against nature, we're working with the flow of
uh-huh.
nature, and that we live in communities of plants and animals and humans.
Right.
And so permaculture in Regenesis is one of three streams that come in as a systems approach. Also, very much emphasis on the work of David Bohm, the physicist, is very integral into the Regenesis community. And when I came first to Patagonia to help start up a project there, Tim Murphy, who is one of the first partners in mm-hmm. the Regenesis team, came as a consultant. I'd met Tim in 1988 and had a regard for him and what he knew at that time. And he did the actual site assessment. Tim is a brilliant at reading landscape. I'd say one of the most able in the world in this field. To read all the story of the land.
Uh-huh.
And when you're beginning a project, you want to understand the foundation with which you're working. You want to understand the flows, the things that influence from
right.
solar, water, all the soils, the underlying geology, and the culture that has occupied this land and interacted with it over time. Tim also developed a conceptual report in conjunction with the owners of this project, which was to be a retreat center. And advised on appropriateness of use of land.
Mm-hmm.
I came to work there to do all the site work. It was a 166-acre project in the southwest near the Mexican border. So during that time, I started also taking more classes in permaculture. It's how we learn. We learn it in classroom situations and we apply it. To become a permaculture designer, there's a 2-year applied system with a mentor teacher, and Tim became my mentor and teacher during that period.
Wow.
So
I
developed my own internships and teaching abilities mm-hmm. also during that time. So this is where that began. Ben Haggard of Regenesis also came in as a teacher of my advanced courses, and then we all started teaching together. And this
great.
Is how the community of permaculture has grown. And it's also reflective of how regenerative processes work. We work together collaboratively, developing beneficial relationships, and that's really at the basis of natural systems resiliency. It's a cooperative way that the world works, from nature, the energetics of nature, and the human communities. And over the years, Regenesis, Pamela and Bob Mang initially formed Regenesis as the founding partners. Tim came in, Ben came in, and Joel and others, and their collaborative has grown to takes systems approaches, understanding landforms as organic living beings, always defined by the watershed, the larger watershed that embraces everything, and the watershed is the place where water is focused in one particular direction. And like Russian dolls, watersheds are nested from within each other, one nested inside the other.
Right.
And we are impacted by those, and we impact them.
Mm-hmm.
So Regenesis thinking is all about what is the essence of this particular place.
Mm-hmm.
And if that essence can be supported to fully express itself, the richness and dynamism of what that system is in totality, what is the potential there, not for it, just for its own expression, but also for the expression of those that live within that system?
Mm-hmm.
How can we, by our actions, have this reciprocal relationship where our actions encourage this natural process of life building on itself, and how does that serve us, and how do we serve it? So we are in relationship with it rather than imposing ourselves on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think like that, we have resilience, not only in terms of our own life, but the system is building resilience in itself.
Right.
And the potential for this expression to be extraordinary, rich, diverse, and deeply emotionally and spiritually satisfying is just there. It gives me goosebumps to feel it when I talk about it. I can feel that level of resonance that's potential, and how it can so simply counter the destructiveness that's going on right now. It's a shift in our thinking to know that we can be part of this, and it doesn't require a lot of money, a lot of years of education. It requires some simple understandings. I think of us in terms of mosaics, that each one of us can be a mosaic in the larger picture. And the more mosaics we have of life-filled, regenerative systems, the more the picture fills in, the more whole it becomes, the more beauty becomes evident.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's so exciting to me. I don't have to save the whole world. But if somebody on a balcony, somebody in a pot, somebody in their front yard or backyard, somebody on 10 acres, 1,000 acres, 10,000 acres can do a little piece of the puzzle, a little piece of the picture of the mosaic. It's like the mycelium in a forest. Everybody is connected. We're all linked together, contributing to this whole system, the whole of our lives, the whole of the thing that nurtures ourselves and nurtures the earth and nurtures everything that is alive.
Mm-hmm. So the mission of Regenesis is to provide, I would say responsible, expert is not quite the right word, but certainly knowledgeable guidance for communities who want to either create transformation in their own community or to begin communities, or
it's part of it is divine, as not divine guidance, but design, which could be design guidance, but to help communities, organizations, businesses to develop a more ableness in individuals and within the organization itself to grow capability, to grow capacity, so that we're not actually doing it for you. We're lifting you up so you can do it for yourselves. And where you need us to come in to help you, then we have a large group of skilled generalists to draw upon that understand how these pieces work together, so that we make it easier for you to understand. There's a learning curve,
right,
obviously. But there's a richness that evolves in this, the potential for a greater economy of service, of work, of reward, of return, in multiple levels, not just in dollars and cents, but in five different levels of economy, from financial to ecological, infrastructural, the human social constructs of humans, building our capacity as humans to understand the world differently and our contribution to it. If we can grow ourselves, then we have then that ability to bring this into the world, to make a contribution from the deepest part of who we are. And if we can engage with that part of ourselves, there's nothing that is more satisfying. You cannot shop and buy that piece. I've tried that.
Probably all of us have.
Yes. And it's also, that contributes to the degenerative nature of investment. But if we can regenerate inside ourselves and feed that core of who we are as beings in the world, there's a sense of having this deep, soulful satisfaction that takes away that longing, the hunger for stuff. It feeds us in a way that nothing else can. And it's about relationship, and it's about how we can contribute to relationship with ourselves, with each other, with place. And Regenesis lifts that up in us.
Wonderful. Wonderful work. Well, I'm really excited about the possibility of watching this in action at some point in the future. And I'm just wondering, have spoken a lot about the large scope, the global sort of, how could I say it, the big umbrella picture, which I think is really good because it's really easy to get kind of lost in the minutia of, you know, our own little community and forget about the larger picture. So I like the image of mosaic, where we become a part of the mosaic. Mm-hmm. I have this wonderful piece of art that's done by an Aboriginal in Australia, and there are, you know, these little
dots
of paint. I mean, they're just amazing, and I just had this flash in my mind when you started to talk about the mosaic of all these little dots representing a group of people or a group of ideas or a group of water holes or something, and then they are, you know, expanded into water holes and images of groups of people talking and, you know, groups of people planting vegetables and so on. They're fascinating. That whole culture is totally fascinating, image-wise.
The picture is lifted up by how many of those dots, how many of the mosaics there are.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. That was a great little connection for me. And I'm wondering as, I think we all try to separate our garbage and be mindful of using plastic, and yet, you know, when you go to a restaurant here in the United States, for instance, you get all this food, and you can't possibly eat it. So, you know, the most, whatever that means, ecological thing to do is to take it home, but then you take it home in the styrofoam thing, although a lot of the restaurants are getting very savvy about this. I don't know if it's actually better, but they have these containers made out of corn, actual corn, which actually dissolves into the earth, which is sounds good. Or they're more like paper, paper products or something. But aside from that, I think that you've inspired some thinking, but I'm wondering about a little few hints of practicality for us beginner people of wanting to make a difference in the world and wanting to nourish and regenerate, which means to make it not just keep it at a neutral good level, but actually to improve it and to provide further nurturing. That's what I've understood.
I think if people can perhaps develop an understanding, and there's some readings that are useful. There's a book called An Introduction to Permaculture, which is about systems thinking, about how we live. My colleague and friend Brad Lancaster has written two of the most wonderful books on water harvesting. They're being translated into some different languages. And they're called Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond. And Brad talks a lot about how we can manage rainwater in our lives, particularly in arid lands. And for myself, as I've really shifted the way I live because of these things that matter to me. So I think very carefully about where I shop. I think about what I want versus what I need. I tend to want to buy used clothes because I love to work outside and I like cotton clothes. So I go to Goodwill and I don't feel bad if I wreck something.
Right.
But I can also find really high quality clothes that others have gotten rid of. And so I do that. There's a wonderful project that I heard about from the woman that created it called Shoparama-rama. And it started in New York, where, and it's now in 126 cities, where people come and give $10 at the door and bring a bag of used clothes. There's not a mirror in the place, and people are there who are silkscreen designers, who are seamstresses or seamstress-ors, if that, the male version of that, but people who know how to alter clothes and handbags and belts and so on. And you come in there and you try things on, and you turn to someone next to you and say, how do I look? Because there's no mirrors. And then if you want it adjusted, or you want something silk screened on it, or you want something to modify it, this happens during that day. So this is fun event, it sounds like to me.
Wow, that sounds fabulous.
So that's brilliant. And then we can also, we can buy in places where, if you go to co-op stores, you can buy things often in bulk. If you go to a health food store, or I hate running out of toilet paper, so I like to buy Seventh Generation, which is a responsible company, and I buy it by the case. It requires a little bit more upfront money, but I buy it for 20% over wholesale from my local health food store. And so I don't think about running out of it. I have a case of toilet tissue. So it's those kind of things. Can you buy in bulk? I wash my plastic bags, as did my mother. I grow as much of my own food as I can because I have space. But if you only have room to put a pot or two on your balcony or in your back porch, if you grow any little part of it and learn how simple that is, the relationship of growing something and the flavor of picking your own ripe tomato or your own fresh head of lettuce.
Right.
There's something about that connection of something that you grew yourself and had that relationship with. And returning that vegetable matter to that little bit of soil, dig it in. You don't have to buy elaborate composting systems. But don't dig in dairy or fat or meat parts, because you'll encourage rodents and you don't want that. But it's those choices. It's turning your lights off. Last year, my husband and I said, what more can we do? So now we turned our lights off more consciously. We saved one-third of our electrical bill.
Really?
One-third of our electrical bill. I have it now down to about $36 a month.
That's amazing.
And we don't need air conditioning because we have an old adobe house that we've managed to been able to insulate over the years, and we've grown up vegetation around it. So in the summer, we have a living air conditioning system. Our garden is 20 degrees cooler than the larger climate around us.
Right.
And at night in the hot weather, I sprinkle the plants with water, which they appreciate, and it drops the temperature another 15 degrees.
Wow.
It's my air conditioning. And we just use fans in the house. We open the doors at night, we close them in the daytime.
Right.
So multiple small strategies. I only drive somewhere if I have to. Every gallon of gas I use, every hour of electricity contributes in this state to the carbon footprint, because coal, which is taken from places that is destroying mountains and destroying rivers and the lives of the people that live there, that all reduces my impact on those people and those environments. And I buy organic food. And if I can't afford organic food, I've learned which foods are least affected by pesticides. I never buy a grape, a raisin, a tomato, or a strawberry that isn't organic. And I buy organic butter. And if my budget is tight, I use less butter.
Right.
But I buy organic because 80%, I think, is the number of antibiotics that are produced in this country, which is huge, actually, in amount, is fed to our animals. And it gets stored in the fat of the animals, so in the fat of the meat, in the fat of the milk, in the cream, in the butter, and it comes into our bodies, which then makes us antibiotic resistant if we ever need it. So this is thinking about the system and how that directly impacts us. If you get sick and need an antibiotic and you've been eating eggs from chickens that are horribly treated in cages, and they're given antibiotics because the conditions are so bad,
right,
then it translates to us.
Right.
And if you ever need it, you're flat out of luck.
Well, that's a great list, Kate. Thanks. It really stimulates thinking and stimulates a lot of research. You know, people make fun of me because I go into the grocery store and I read labels these days because I want to watch my salt. I don't want to ingest a lot of chemicals. And sometimes, sometimes what they call organic canned products actually have other things in them I don't want to eat.
That's
like sugar.
Right. That's right.
So it's been a really, my shopping trips are often very long. So it's been, it's been great to just take more time to get connected.
Yeah. Thank you. I think the one thing I want to add that I didn't say was if you know someone who's growing locally, buy from them.
Right.
That brings it back home. And the other thought I thought about is if there's somebody in your neighborhood that loves to grow stuff and has the room to grow it, wouldn't it be fun to see if they wanted to grow a garden with a few neighbors?
Right.
And if there was a big job that you would get together and sort of maybe have a potluck day and make it a celebration and work together and dig the dirt. It's cheaper than going to a gym, and you don't need a uniform.
Great. Well, Kate, we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much for a very stimulating conversation and for sharing your life with us. It's been really beautiful.
Thank you, Phyllis. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, great. Great. And for you listeners, you now have homework. Okay, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.